I'd like to thank all of our readers. Okay. At this time, I would like to introduce our first speaker, and I'll give you Phil.
All right, Phil. Phil, so,
I'm an act. My name is Philip.
Hey,
first thing I need to say, I think, is that I've got a lot of feelings going on, and I was checking them out and going, is it nervous? Is it angry? Is it upset? Is it concerned? And you know, I've been led to believe that in working a 6 and 7 step, that being judgmental is one of the things that really keeps me separated from the people in these rooms and keeps me separated from the people in the world that I live in. And I guess what I'm feeling is real judgmental, and I think in order to be here now, what I need to do is get past what seems to be going on inside of me. And that, a lot of that has to do with what's gone on in the two main speaker meetings here the last two nights. And I'm real troubled. And if I act like I'm not troubled, y'all are going to go, what a phony son of a bitch he is. Because clearly he's not talking about what's going on with him. And what I've learned here is that if I get real here now with you, there's a chance that I might experience this thing called recovery. And if I stuff away the stuff that I'm afraid you might think less of me for or judge me for some reason for having, that what I end up feeling is very alone. And I know how to do that. I spent most of my life being alone. And what I need to say is that what I heard tonight and I heard last night was a message of hope from people who've got a lot of clean time. And I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed at the behavior that I observed, the disrespect that I observed the last couple nights. And now that I've said that, maybe what I can do is come back in a moment and talk about why we're here. And that's learning about being God-centered. See, I got a phone message that said, you're going to come up from, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm a member of the Together We Can home group in Narcotics Anonymous, which I happen to believe is the rockin'est home group in Narcotics Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. and Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at 1042 Preston Avenue in Charlottesville, Virginia. So if you're ever in Charlottesville, either of those evenings, I'll give you my phone number. You should stop by and see why I think it's the rockin'est home group in Narcotics Anonymous. I have a sponsor who's a member of Narcotics Anonymous, who's taught me a working understanding of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Narcotics Anonymous, who happens to have a sponsor who's a member of Narcotics Anonymous, who's done the same thing for him, who happens to have a sponsor in Narcotics Anonymous, who's done the same thing for him. And if you don't have a sponsor, you're really missing out on what I believe is the most important relationship that can happen here. I was told when I first got here that I really had to be careful about relationships, but I wasn't told that I need to have no relationships. I was told that I needed to develop some relationships for the first time in my life. And most importantly, what I needed to do is develop a relationship with a man. See, I already knew how to develop relationships with women. It's what I've been doing all my life to avoid Philip. And I did it very well. And I use people. And I use people to avoid experiencing the consequences of my own behavior. And what it did is it kept me sick. It kept me from experiencing what I needed to learn. I mean, I got jammed behind a lot of the stuff I did, but I assure you, I didn't pay the freight for what I did in my life. So when people hear us talk about wanting justice, what I pray for is mercy, because justice wouldn't allow me to be here out this late in the evening on my own without any kind of bracelets. It'd probably wake up in the morning looking through a window about that big, and that's how big my world would be today, but there's been some grace that's happened in my life, and I guess what I want to talk about is that grace. But see, I thought that I was on the phone. I was told that the workshop was on God's will, and I thought, "Well, that's great, man! They called me from Virginia to come up to Maryland to tell you all about God's will." And I said, "What do I know about God's will?" So I started thinking. Of course, that's not the name of the workshop, so fortunately, I don't have to belabor that point. But usually, after the fact, I become very aware that what I just did was not God's will. Usually after the fact, what I find out is what I just did was Philip. And I recognize that because I see a frown on your face. I see somebody going, oh, God, shrugging the shoulders and turning their head, and I have this real strong sense of, like, gas burning in the pit of my gut, and I go, oh, that was Philip. That wasn't God. But I was thinking, you know, what God-centeredness, my God. It almost feels arrogant to attempt to talk about something like that because I don't know what God is. I don't know who God is. You know, I was told when I first got here, there's only one thing you need to know about God, Philip, is that you're not. Oh, okay, well, I can do that. Because most of my life I've lived as if I had some kind of, like, direct line to some higher knowing and higher understanding, and then lived as if. And there are an awful lot of people, some of them in positions of authority in our culture, who proved that I was incorrect in some of my assumptions about what I could get away with and what I couldn't. I sat down here this evening, and Linda and I started chatting because we noticed that we must be the other speakers. And we were interesting, like, are you the second or the first speaker or the other speaker? And I said, I don't know, you know, I think I'm the speaker here. But it finds out she's from Arizona, and my heart's in Arizona. I really, I think if I live anywhere in my spirit, it probably lives somewhere in a mesa in Arizona. And it seems like hers does as well. And I was thinking, well, that's what God-centeredness is. God-centeredness for me today, I guess, is about noticing what's happening around me. Yeah, most of my life I was real good about noticing what was going on with me and ignoring what was going on with you and how you're responding to me and what your needs or interests or, you know, preferences might be, and making sure that I got what I wanted. And that was all that I was interested in. I mean, I didn't have relationships with people before I got here. I took hostages and I held them and I used them for what I thought I needed or wanted at any given time. And I really didn't give, you know, much of a damn about what happened in the results of our relationship. And I was thinking, how has that changed? And I was thinking about, well, one of the places it shows up in the 12th step, it talks about the way we know that we've had this spiritual awakening is that we actually experience a certain amount of peace inside of ourselves. That for the first time, maybe in our lives, we feel comfortable inside of our own skin. I was thinking, wow, you know, I have moments, you know, when I actually feel comfortable inside of my own skin. And I believe that's a result of working the steps of this program with a sponsor. I believe it's a result of developing that relationship with a man who treated me with love unconditionally for the first time in my life, so I could begin to believe, maybe, that there was some power larger than any of us individually that might be capable of experiencing and offering that love unconditionally, just like this man had. I would come and I'd say, well, this is what I did, and it was really dumb. And he'd say, well, you know, Philip, that's probably not in your best interest. That's probably not about recovery. But, you know, I understand why you might make a mistake like this. And let me tell you about some of the things that I did when I was first getting here. And this is what happened for me. And what I found out is that most of my learning since I've been, you know, trying to get clean has come from my mistakes. You know, something goes really well and you have this thing turn out and it's a success and you feel kind of good about it and you look around and you go, how did that happen? I don't know. It just, God, it was really neat, you know. But when things go really bad, I can usually look real close to figure out why it went wrong. And it's always me. You know, it's something that I did to avoid some real clear information that was being presented to me about what was in my best interest to do next that I disregarded. You know, that still quiet voice we're taught to search for in recovery, you know, sit quietly and listen. Well, I always had that voice. It said, Philip, don't do that. And I'd go, shut up. And I would chemically quiet that voice. And then I chemically quieted it long enough, consistently enough, and heavily enough that it went mute for a while. And it really did. I mean, periodically it would wake up. I noticed at some point in my life that the proximity of cold concrete near here always was kind of these momentary spiritual awakenings. I'm not sure why, but I felt connected with God when I was forced to sit on concrete inside of those buildings with steel. Immediately it was like, I've heard it called jailhouse religion. Now, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to diminish the experience by something as cheap as that, but that would be when I would look outside of myself for help. When I would look for something bigger than myself for help was when I noticed that what was now controlling my life was obviously much bigger than myself, you know, concrete and steel. And it was a long time before I ever sincerely engaged in any kind of real search for that relationship, because I was raised in Arizona. And my mother's people were Mormons. I'm not here to talk about good or bad religions, please don't misunderstand me. And my father's people were Southern Baptists. And they had a little different perception of the way the spiritual world worked. And because if you weren't a Baptist, you were going to hell. And the other side of the family was real convinced that if you weren't a Mormon, you were going to hell. And I assure you, there were people on both sides of my family that probably ought to go to hell. But it didn't seem to be based on the religion they were hooked up with. It seemed to me like it was much more based on the kind of behavior they engaged in. And so by the time I was about 12 years old, I decided they could all go to hell. Because this power, this God that I was presented with, very clearly was much more interested in what I did with my hands under my covers at night.
Hello.
Hello. Then starving children in India that we were cleaning our plates for every night at the dinner table. I never got that. So if I clean my plate, it's better. And if I don't clean my plate, it's worse. Now, I don't know. That's maybe metaphysical and I haven't gotten there yet. But I've never understood what the relationship was my plate in India. I don't know. Help me after the meeting, would you? But it seemed to me what I was presented with was a very judgmental, a very wrathful, a very vindictive, a very punishing God. And I knew that I was really a sick son of a bitch early on. I knew. See, I don't think, for the longest time, I wanted to blame drugs and who I became. But a story that I remembered a few years ago, I'm not sure I've shared in a long time, was that at 10 years old, I had a paper route. And my wife knows the story. And they had contests, you know, and I wasn't a winner. I knew early on, I'm not a winner, okay? And they had these contests, and you could, like, get bikes and sports equipment, and I don't know about any old enough when kids used to do bike routes instead of all the, now the big guys take the jobs away from the kids. But if you sold enough subscriptions, you'd win contests. And I wanted to be a winner so bad my whole life, and I knew I wasn't. So what I would do is I would cancel your newspaper and write a new subscription to you. Okay? I would continue to deliver the paper to her, and she would be my new account, but I'd get a point. I'd get, like, a new subscription point on my little, you know, my little book. I never carried more than 38 newspapers, and I won every trip. I won every prize. I won every district-wide event that ever happened, and all these other kids are, like, filling up their bikes and their bags, and they got all these newspapers, and they're, like, struggling under. I got 38 papers. Yeah. I was running two sets of books. I hadn't done my first drug yet, you know? And I'm running two. I'm a liar, a cheat, a thief, and a con long before I got loaded. The drugs didn't do this shit to me. I'm a dope fiend. And that's who I am as a person. The drugs saved my life. See, what I come to believe is that in my adolescence, I was so desperate and hopeless and afraid and alone and despairing that drugs kept me from killing myself. During a period, I really come to believe that those drugs were my savior. And of course, then I developed a relationship. You know how what happens when you develop a relationship with a savior? He doesn't have to keep saving you. You just keep the relationship going anyway. And long after the point that they were actually doing me good, I maintained that relationship with those substances. And one time I got sick, and my father didn't do a lot to help me out. But one of the things he did is he did my paper route one Sunday morning because I was really sick. We got 38 complaints. Because he took the set of books that was like, you know, the cookbooks for, you know, the district manager guy and delivered them to all the wrong houses. He said, I don't understand what happened. I followed your route perfectly well, and I never explained to him what went wrong. But I realized then that, you know, there really were consequences to my behavior out there in the world, that what I did here really did have some kind of effect on those. And those people didn't deserve not to get their Sunday paper just because I wanted to go to Mexico and see a bullfight. Or I wanted to go to San Diego and go deep sea fishing. And I did. And, you know, it was all a lie. I was a thief. I stole those things. You know, on an amends list, there's this kind of mythical entity called the newspaper people who I stole from. And I don't know, you know, so sometimes I'll go buy a newspaper box, we got them in town, and I'll put money in and not take a paper. I don't know how do you make amends on that one, you know? Give me some money, you know? Somewhere in the universe, maybe it kind of goes out and, you know, settles some of my karma and, you know, in regards to the stealing newspapers. So I don't know what to do. Anyway, I'm sure God really cares about that. God-centeredness. Help me. You know, I woke up one morning and The previous year, I'd had an extremely successful business and a lot of equipment, a lot of employees, and a home and a family and a wife and a child. And somewhere in the next year, a few things changed, and I woke up in a shack in the woods. And I'd sold off the equipment because it was kind of cold that winter, and I really wasn't very interested in going to work. And there was a few things I thought I needed a lot more that the value of that property would bring me. And so, of course, I stayed home near the stove and did them. And I woke up one morning and I said, you know, I think what I need to do is just die. Because I'm not doing anybody any good here. I'm not helping my family at all. I'm not helping myself at all. And I'm doing an awful lot of harm to people I really care about. And I'd been in and out of the rooms for years because the courts had sent me here. And people had said, you know, it really would be a good idea for society if you'd do something different. And I didn't want to hear that. Because I didn't believe that there could be a power greater than myself that could be loving and caring. I had never heard that. I'd never been in lots and lots of meetings, and I'd never heard that. And that morning, I walked outside, and it was a beautiful surrounding. It was a real shithole of a shack, but the physical setting around it was real pretty. And see, I was kind of proud because I never became homeless. So I had a home in the woods. And I walked outside, and I remembered hearing people in these rooms say, you know, if you ask God in the morning to help you stay clean, you know, that there's a power available. And that morning, the prayer I uttered, I'm not going to put on tape, but it's really not very nice. And it's not the sort of prayer you'd hear anywhere other than an NA meeting, but it was real, and it came from my gut. And it was like, if there's anything out there that can help me, I'm willing, because I'm whipped. I give it up. And something happened. You know, something happened in that moment that I, you know, earlier tonight Greg was talking about surrender. And there was a surrender. It wasn't a perfect and it wasn't a total, and there was reservations, and there still probably are reservations that I'm learning about over the years. But it was the beginning of a surrender, of admitting that I was incapable under my own power to do the things that I needed to do to have any kind of impact whatsoever in the quality of my life. You know, and that's I believe, for me, is where my recovery begins. And what I've heard from an awful lot of other people here, that's where their recovery begins too, is when we become willing to admit that we're incapable under our own power to make any kind of change. And that's really where my relationship with this power begins, because, see, I didn't have to get loaded that day. And I didn't believe that I didn't have to get loaded, but I didn't have to get loaded that day. And I got to a meeting that night. And, you know, I'd like to continue the story, and of course, and I've never used since then, and that's not true. You know, because I decided at a year that if you could stay clean for a year, you couldn't be an addict. I mean, could you? I mean, staying clean for a day is kind of outrageous. And I've been locked up for months, you know, in periods of time, and I didn't stay clean then either, though, did I? I stayed clean, I thought that was a long time, and I figured there's no way you could be an addict and stay clean, so I celebrated my first anniversary. And I've met a lot of people who've done the same thing since then, and it was horrible. If I had any doubt whatsoever in my mind that I really was an addict, then all the pain and misery and paranoia and fear and frustration and terror and just horrible aloneness was all back. And I prayed again. And it only had to be one night. And I'm very thankful for that. And I prayed again. In a real way, for really the first time, I kind of took for granted what was going on most part of that year. And it was a real rededication to what this process had to offer me. And I believe that I'm clean by the grace of a power greater than myself. I call God because it communicates for us what that is. But I don't have to describe that God to you. It's a very personal relationship for me. I feel the sense and the presence of that power. I had the just extreme privilege and opportunity last weekend of being in Mexico for their first regional convention. And if they would have seen the group of people here tonight, they would have just died. They would have fell out screaming, because there were 350 people in the room, and none of those people had ever been in a meeting with more than 50 people. And I mean, there was just tears of joy and wailing, and I'm fluent in Spanish, and it was just a wonderful, incredible experience. And one of the places that I found my God that week was at these pyramids outside of town. A new friend I have in my life, called a man by the name of Raimundo, took me out to these pyramids. They're the second largest pyramids in the world, and they're 14,000 years old. They were built by Mayans who created a calendar that looks like that's just like the calendar we use today. And the power that I felt on the top of that pyramid was just like electricity running through me. It was the presence of a power that said, it's okay. And that's all I wanted to hear. Nobody in my family ever said, Philip. Well, that wasn't my name then. How could they? It's okay. Nobody ever said, it's okay. And all my life, the drugs that I chased, and the women that I chased, and the relationships that I chased, and the people that I wanted to come, you know, somehow validate who I was, I wanted them to say, it's okay, and it's going to be okay. And today when I start my morning in that time of quiet prayer and meditation, it's a very, I think, the key ingredient in my recovery. What I experience is a moment of, it's okay. And I believe that's what all of us want. I wanted to find the drug that would make me feel okay in my own skin. And I assure you, unless it's been designed in the last few years, if it was out there, I tried it. And for brief periods of time, some of them actually work. But, you know, my relationship with Narcotics today, Anonymous today, is the most important relationship that I have. I have a wife who loves me dearly, who would do absolutely anything for me, who I have the happiest relationship I've ever had in my life. But that relationship is only possible because of my relationship with Narcotics Anonymous. And I know today that the only reason the relationship that I have with Narcotics Anonymous is possible is because of the relationship with a loving and caring God that I found here. When I was told I had the freedom, see, I was terrified because I knew that there was so very little bit left of me when I got here that if I involved myself in anything big or cosmic, that I would just turn to dust and cease to exist because there wasn't enough of me to handle anything big. And I know all of you felt that in some way. And what I, and much to many people's chagrin, the truth of the matter is there's 1,000 times more Philip today than there ever was before. There's times when that's what it is. You know, there's a lot more of me than there used to be, and that is what it is. It's mostly, you know, it's that relationship with that power that allows me to believe that today, you know, that I'm one of those any addicts, you know, who can stop using drugs. And who has, by the grace of that power, lost the desire to use drugs? I have no desire. You know, and I have. I believe I'm in that process of finding a new way to live. And I believe the only way that I can find that way is through working the 12 steps of this program with a sponsor, is through being of service to this fellowship, is through finding a way to give back what's been so freely given to me. You know, it's. I often hear in the meetings that I think we leave off a little piece that says, the most important person in any meeting is a newcomer. Well, that's the first part of that phrase. Because it says the reason that that person is so important is because the only reason we can keep what we have by the grace of God, by the 12 steps of this program, by the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, by the help of the support of a sponsor and a home group and the service we've been a part of, the only way we can keep that is by giving it away. That's why that newcomer is important. And every time there's a newcomer in a meeting, we all know what that feels like in a meeting. You hear things you haven't heard in months. People are talking about one day at a time. Just don't use no matter what. You know, get the phone and use the phone. Go to meetings, read the literature, pray. We say all the right stuff when there's a newcomer there. And when they're not there, we all talking to, you're the bitch, and this and that. We're all whining and carrying on like crazy. And newcomers, oh boy, well, work the steps or die, motherfucker. It's amazing. And that's why that newcomer is important. Because I have a disease that has amnesia as a real big part of it. Oh, it wasn't that bad. You know, I'm a drug addict, but I'm in recovery now, and I don't have to, like, do all that basic stuff. Newcomer, well, listen. If you don't work this, you know, and all of a sudden I find myself making those suggestions. That who do I need to be making those suggestions to? To me. What is my? I'm repeating my sponsor. What he told me on the phone 15 minutes earlier. Well, I don't want to do that stuff. And then 15 minutes later, I'm a newcomer, and I'm saying, well, listen, what you need to do is I'm going. That's what he just got done telling me. You know, and that's why it's so important that we acknowledge a newcomer in a meeting. I mean, I wasn't any value. When I was here the first day, I was no value to you. I was no value to this fellowship. I was a drain. Y'all said, keep coming back, but try to do it clean. You know? I was smoking then. They said, let's go outside and have a cigarette, you know, so the meeting can continue. You know? Because I was the guy who was like, well, let me tell you about the time, you know, and interrupt. You know? I need to remember who I was as a newcomer and go, I was the most important. I don't think so. I was the most disruptive element in that room. You know, I wasn't the most, you know, and maybe it was good for y'all to be reminded because that's what we look like. And oftentimes I see people kind of get critical and judgmental of newcomers because they act a certain way in a meeting. I was in a meeting a few months ago, and kind of in the middle of the meeting, this guy sort of busts in. He's like drunk, and he looks around and kind of waves his arm and babbles some stuff and then wanders out the door, and everybody laughs. And I got angry because that was me. You know, because I didn't come here clean. I didn't come here with the... look around this room, honestly, and look at who we are. If you could stay clean without us, wouldn't you? I mean, come on. Look at us. You know, if you could stay home and watch, you know, whatever it is you watch, and did that, and take a hot bath, and, you know, I can't do this. I need each and every one of you. And the thing that really concerns, there's some traditional workshops I've been at the last couple of days, and what really rings so true for me is when I'm out of town or when I go to a friend's anniversary or I go someplace, there's a couple of meetings in Richmond I go to on a fairly regular basis, and if my wife and I show up, we're the white face in the room. Because we have a dear friend who's there, you know, for his anniversary, and I hear stuff that night that I need. I need to hear that. You know, when we find ways to pull ourselves apart, to segregate ourselves off by class or race or sexual identity or creed, religion, or any of that old crap that we do, that's why those traditions are there, because I need to hear your story. Because your story is my story, and everything I can do to make myself different from you is the power of my disease working in my life. And everything I can do to identify with you, to know that you are me, gives me hope for my own recovery. You know, part of me hates conventions and part of me loves conventions because this is where I experience diversity in a real way. You know, and so many of our areas and regions have become less and less diverse. We've become more homogeneous instead of heterogeneous. That's what happens when I use three-syllable words. I got no business in public or behind your back. I need to keep it simple. And the other thing that I need to do is acknowledge the reality of the clock and let you know that this may not have had a great deal to do with God-centeredness instead of self-centeredness, but what I do know is that there's a loving God who works through the fellowship and the program of Narcotics Anonymous and has made it possible for me a day at a time to not have a desire to use drugs, to not have the desire to steal from you, to not have the desire to take advantage of you, to allow me at the end of the day to lay my head on a pillow and say, thank you, God, for another day clean. And thanks for letting me share.
I'd like to thank Philip for a fine job. And now for our second speaker, I'll give you Linda.
I have to get water first. No, that's not mine. Go ahead. Is it your...
I don't know.
I'm an addict. My name's Linda.
Hi, Linda.
I'm not going to make too many comments about this. I usually do, but I'm going to not make comments about the microphone tonight. They intimidate me. Thank you for sharing what you did when you first started sharing. And I don't need to share anymore. I was feeling a little overwhelmed when I was walking around. They said check in before the meeting. I walked downstairs and I ended up going in the room across there and just praying for a few minutes because I was having those mixed feelings about a convention all of a sudden, and it's happened to me before. And it is because of what you shared about the diversity and about things I don't like. And opinions I have, which is actually a miracle that I can even say that I have opinions. So I'm really grateful for that. I was asked, a couple months ago, we were all asked, and I find it really easy to put this out of my mind when I'm attending college because I'm really busy, except for the last couple of days. In the last couple of days, what I've been thinking about is self-centeredness and how I was self-centered in my active addiction and how I'm still self-centered today, because it's really important for me to be real about that, because it hasn't all gone away since I got clean. I wish it had, but it hasn't. in my active addiction, and I started using at a young age at 12, I was self-centered before that. And some of the main way I was self-centered was that, and I don't know where we get it from, I really don't, and it's still a question I have, is I really cared what you thought about me. I really did. I probably was 5 years old, and I cared what you thought about me. So I took that into my active addiction. I remember going to school before I picked up my first drug, and I found ways to get your attention. And I never thought that I would even look at that. I was one of those class clowns that would be in the back of the classroom making weird sounds, like bird calls from the back of the classroom. No, I'm not doing any bird calls tonight. I would do all kinds of things like that to get attention. And that was about me wanting you to like me. So very early on, I learned how to do that, and I took that with me. You know, there's two significant stories of my active addiction, and I'm only going to share them very briefly. And one is that I started learning how to steal very young. And I started stealing before I started using. I would go into my brother's room and my sister's room, and I would see something I liked. It could be anything. And I would take it. And I would hide it. You know, hide it under my bed. I found out later that we all were doing the same thing. So if one of us was missing, like, the big super ball, you know, one of my siblings had it, or vice versa. So there's a lot of behaviors I had before active addiction started in my life. So as soon as I picked up the first drug, and addiction took over for me very quickly. My mother was in her full-fledged addiction by the time I picked up. So I started stealing and manipulating and doing all those things that we do to get what we want, to get the drugs that I wanted at the time. And that's what I did. And the two stories, because I'm only going to share these and then I'm going to move on, was when I was 12 years old. This is a funny story now. And one of the reasons why I'm going to share this is my mother's in the room tonight. My mother's been clean for a while, and she hasn't really heard me share. And I haven't done a lot of this workshop thing. This is not something I want to do a lot either. My mother went to a Catholic school in Tucson, Arizona, and she had a couple nuns visiting. And my addiction had really just started. And you know, I don't know how we learn this stuff either. I guess it's my mother's fault. I learned it at this. I watched her do it. I went into the nun's room where they were staying. They were staying in the house where we were, and I went into their room, and basically I stole a bunch of pills. And I didn't know really what they were. I was 12 years old. I figured they might do something, so I took them, and I bartered them for other drugs. And I was supposed to be babysitting my brothers and sisters. And I had already gotten all of them high for their first time. And I'm 12, and they're just a lot younger. I'm not going to try to figure out how old they were. They were young. Like, the youngest was 6. So I left them in the house alone, and I went and I bartered the drugs that I stole. And the end result was I went into my first blackout. And I messed up my body really bad physically. And I woke up the next morning and I didn't know what happened. And I went in, I looked in the bathroom, and my face was all messed up because I had fallen off of a bicycle and hurt myself. And I went out and I heard cartoons on, and my brothers and sisters were watching cartoons. And I went into that room and they told me some of what had happened. And that was the first time I said I'd never do it again. And my addiction took off so fast that within weeks, short weeks, there was a lot of things happening in my life, and they were very destructive. At the end of my addiction, the self-centeredness continued for 10 years. from 12 to 21. And I ended up on my 21st birthday, or a couple of days after my 21st birthday, in a bar. I had been in a relationship for a few years, and obviously I became very much under the influence. And in front of the woman I was involved with at the time, I was sexually making advances at someone else. And I share that because that is the self-centeredness that my disease went from. Not one being worse than the other, but that's just where I went in 10 years of addiction. That 3 months after that incident, and I had spent a long time, you know, and this is self-centered within itself, thinking about how I was going to take my life. And I'm really lucky I didn't. And from 12 to 21, I believe I was on a path of killing myself. And I believe I was using chemicals to survive. And that's kind of a contradiction now, but it makes a lot of sense to me. It's probably why I survived, even though I really didn't want to. So basically, having suicidal thoughts and being unsuccessful at trying to support the habit that I had at the time, those words came out of my mouth, I need help. And that when I say that, that it didn't just like, I need help, just didn't come out of my mouth that easy. It was a lot of family members coming into my life day after day, and they had all came into treatment. My mom had already went into treatment, my brothers and sisters had been through treatment, so I had been introduced to Narcotics Anonymous already. I had been to my first NA meeting with a lot of people. I had received my first NA, actually they were chips at the time, they weren't key tags. And it was hidden in the bottom drawer that I had. Before the day that I got on the phone and tried to find the detox and the treatment center, I went to a church. And it's a church that I went to as a little person, actually, and as a teenager. And it's not something I do today. I do know, though, that in that building, I also asked for help, and it was days before this all happened. I'm not going to really go into a whole long thing about the relationship I have with my higher power. It's been a huge journey for me, huge, huge. But I have one today, and it started that day. And since that day, I have built on that, and I've struggled, and I've tried to become more God-centered every day, in whatever way is okay for me. And how I'm self-centered today is, you know, I'd love to say that I still don't care what people think. No. Because I do. In the last 3 or 4 months of my recovery, I have had some physical problems, and I've had to put chemicals in my body. And it is amazing, just from going through that, how some of that self-centeredness has come back. Now, it's not on the scale that it was when I was using, but how it's affected how I feel about myself. And part of that is because what was wrong with me had to do with the outside of my body, because I had this rash, and I didn't know where it came from, and I think it came from a tanning bed, and you don't want to hear the long story, and the people that know me don't want to hear it anymore. But what I had to realize in the last few months is that even though the steps have helped me, the times I've worked through the steps with the sponsors that I've had, it's helped me to be less self-centered and more God-centered. But when this physical thing was happening outside of my body, I realized how much I really judge me by my outsides. I mean, it's like I kind of know this on a scale that I don't even like to talk about, because I like have combs in like everywhere. So I know there's some vanity in my life, you know, and I have an ego. And part of that, though, and this can be really confusing for me, part of that for someone who had no self-esteem, none, when I got here, none. I was, you know, right when I started using, I had acne, all, you know, it was bad. I had braces in my mouth. So I already had no self-esteem before the braces and before the acne, so I don't need to tell you what happened after that. And that has been a struggle for me since I've been in recovery. It still is. It's a lot better. But it was really hard for me to admit how much I still judge my insides by my outsides. I was at a family get-together just a few weeks ago, and I tried to give my mother eye contact, like, you know, please, you know, don't bug me too much, leave me alone, I'm not doing really well, you know, trying to do that thing I used to do with, like, people I was in relationships with, read my mind, please read my mind, because I don't know how to tell you. And of course, she didn't read my mind, and I didn't tell, because I didn't tell her, and I ended up snapping. It was, you know, it was a quick snap. It was like, you know, that irritated snapping thing we do. Well, I do. Excuse me. I know no one can relate to that. And it really, really upset me because it reminded me of me in active addiction. It reminded me of what I used to do and how I used to be. Because I was angry. I was hurting really bad for a lot of years, and I was really angry. And I did not... Obviously, I didn't treat myself well, so I didn't treat other people well. And that night, I cried. And it really helped me because the people that really care about me also told me some stuff I didn't want to hear. And lately, in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I've had people that really care about me tell me what I need to do. And these same people were telling me what I need to do in my life 4 or 5 months ago. And I didn't do it. And whether or not my physical problems have anything to do with that, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. It really doesn't matter. What it matters is that I'm doing what I need to do to take care of myself now. And part of that has to do with leaving a job I'm working right now. And that's hard. It's hard for me because I have worked for, ever since I was 15, whether I was supporting my habit or not. And we were talking about this, a group of us were talking about how, whether it's a relationship or whether it's a job we have, how all that affects how we feel about ourselves. And really, this really ties into self-centeredness. And it ties in for me of how much I care, like, what people at work think of me, what my family thinks of me, what my friends think of me, what, you know, the people I'm sponsoring, what my sponsor thinks of me. And sometimes I care so much still that I hurt myself, that I say yes when I mean no still, that I let those boundaries get crossed over instead of just saying, no, I don't want to do that, no, I can't do that, whatever. And when I was thinking about, you know, I'd also like to say that I wasn't thinking about what I was going to share, and that's a lie too. I knew I needed to share about this. Because even since I've been at the convention this weekend, some of this has came up for me. Recently, some of my family members have retired, are coming down here. My parents are retiring down in Bethany Beach, and my sister just moved down here. And I spent 8 years in Arizona. I got clean in Maryland, and I moved to Arizona, basically to run away after my brother died from this disease. And now that I've moved back to the area I'm in Frederick, my family's kind of moving to the beach. And, you know, I ought to be grateful for that because now I have places to stay at the beach. But I'm self-centered still, and it means that I have to drive 3 hours versus 15 minutes. So I don't like that. You know, and that's the honest part. You know, and as soon as I'm able to be honest, really, about how I feel about it, then I can move on to acceptance and working the steps through it and blah, 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 and get on with what I need to get on with. I have to have another drink of water. Well, The only other thing I want to share is there's a few significant things that I know help move me from self-centeredness to God-centeredness, and one of those things is service work. In all the forms that I've done service work in, whether it's been being a sponsor, whether it's been making coffee, whether it's been activities chair when I was in southeastern Arizona, because those things have helped me to show you who I really am. The first time I made coffee at a group, and I have shared this with some people in here, I really cared what you thought about the coffee, too. And it was one of those meetings that they had the huge coffee pot, you know, like 75 cups. I don't volunteer to make coffee at those meetings still. You know, I remember getting directions the first time. They said, put like 3 or 4 scoops in. Well, I forgot that because one of the things when I got here is I had no memory. You know, I've had to work on memory. I really have. So I forgot the directions, so I did that count 75 teaspoons out. 1, 2. Because it had to be right. It had to be exactly right. And I know I would wait for those first few people to come get their coffee, and I'd be like on the sidelines waiting. They'd pour their coffee, take a drink, and I'd wait for the reaction. Because most of us make, you know, we state our opinions, right? So I graduated from that. So from making coffee to be like activities chair in southeastern Arizona, where you're worried about a little bit more than like if people like the coffee. You're worried about like, well, more than 10 people show up for the dance. You know, blah, blah, blah. I don't even need to go on about that. The other one is being responsible for me. When I moved to Arizona, I came back a couple years later and I had someone in my life come up to me and say, you know what I've really noticed about you? You, like, take responsibility for you, like, for your life. And that has been one of the biggest things that has helped me to be less self-centered and more God-centered, is just taking care of, being responsible for what I do and what I don't do. And the third is relationships with the people in my life. It took me a long time to really understand that me caring so much about what you thought of me was really self-centered. It did. So it's been a challenge for me in all of my relationships with my family, with my friends, and the other relationships that I've had in my life to really accept that when someone says to me that they like me for this, or they love me for this, or whatever, that they're not lying to me. Because it's taken me a lot of 24 hours in recovery to really believe what you say. For the most part, I can believe that. Now, in the last few months, since I haven't been feeling good about myself, that's been harder. And that's the bottom line for me. Because I believe that my relationship with my higher power has everything to do with my relationship with myself. If I am not having a good relationship with myself today, then I'm not having a good relationship with my higher power, period. And if I'm not having that, then then I'm going to really care about what you think, and I'm going to really care about what you're doing. See, I feel better already just like saying all this. This journey of recovery for me, I love it. And I would rather do something else most of the time. I would rather like probably even right now before this meeting, I was thinking, you know, I really need to study for that exam on Monday. Not that I'd rather be doing that, because that's a lie. I wouldn't rather be studying for the exam on that day. Although, talking to a bunch of people, I could think of other things I'd rather be doing. Like, see, hot tub. You know, think of a lot of other things. I always share this, because I did not think that I was going to get clean. My family had all came into treatment. They were going to meetings. They were accumulating clean time. I was still using, and I didn't think I was going to get clean. So when I ended up in a treatment center, still in denial, still lying, I still didn't think I was going to get clean. And tonight when we did the countdown, and I've been to a few conventions, so I've been in a few countdowns. Every time I stand up, the people around me were like, oh, you know, jump around. I'm still afraid of my clean time. I still am. I feel really grateful. But when I stand up, it's like I want to stand up, acknowledge it, and then I want to sit back down. It's like, okay, 5 seconds, I'm sitting back down. Because I really believe in Just for Today in this fellowship. Because I've watched a lot of people die. And I've watched a lot of people not come back. And I have had a lot of people that I've called friends who I really don't even know anymore. I don't know them anymore. I haven't seen them for various periods of time. So I really just treasure every day that I stay clean. And I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to speak, and I'll keep coming back.
Before we open the meeting up to those who'd like to share, please remember to come up to the microphone one at a time. Also, try to keep in mind that there are other addicts who are waiting to share. If you don't want to be recorded, please inform the person taping so that they can turn off the recorder while you are sharing. The mic's open.
My name's Steve. I'd like to thank the God of my understanding for giving me another day clean, and I have a great deal of gratitude for the fellowship in Narcotics Anonymous, because I know when I got here, like, I couldn't even talk, and like, it was like the speaker just said, you know, if I could have supported my habit and kept using, I wouldn't have gotten clean. But I had no money and no friends, and I was getting kicked out of my house, and, you know, so, you know, but also, it just got to the point where I knew that either if the drugs didn't kill me, like, one of you addicts surely would, you know what I mean, because, like, I was just, like, too dumb and, like, too naive to be out in that world, you know what I mean, because, like, if the drugs didn't get me, like, another addict would have, you know what I mean? And I believe that to this day. And, yeah, so I came in here, and, I don't know. It's been a long, you know, journey. But, you know, I'm real grateful. It's funny, we came down here, and I'm speaking of naive kind of actions. And a couple of friends, and they said, oh, you know, we were talking about a couple weeks back, and said, well, you know, we're going to get a room in Ocean City. And I said, well, Ocean City is booked up. Ah, no, it's not. We'll be fine, you know. Da, 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 da. So we get down here, and all the hotels are booked. And, you know, they're two-night minimums and blah, blah, blah. And we've been up for about, you know, 26 hours. And, you know, we're sitting in the convention center. And, you know, I'm looking down at this little book, and it says, spiritually refreshed and glad to be alive. And I said, well, you know what? That's true. You know, like, in all honesty, like the promise of this convention has already been fulfilled, and I haven't slept in 26 hours, and I've been living on apples and rye bread, and but it's really okay, you know what I mean? Like it really is. And I'm real grateful for that. And I remember sitting on this wall outside of a hotel where our friends were staying, and non-registered guests were not allowed to stay at the hotel. We weren't allowed to go take a shower or take a nap or use a bathroom. I'm thinking, well, geez, you know, and I just remember praying, like, God, please, just let me get to a bed. Just let me get to a bed. And my sponsor always says, you know, God always answers our prayers. Sometimes the answer is no. But, like, you know, we found a bed and we found a place to stay, and everything worked out. but, you know, and I just, this entire weekend has been one big adventure, and I'm really enjoying my recovery. I was going bonkers because I got down here last night and didn't get to a meeting, and man, I just need to get to a meeting and share about where I'm at and stuff like that, and it's good to be up here. Thanks.
According to my time, I think we're about out of time. And could someone come up and please read just for today?
Hi, family. My name is Dominic, and I'm an addict.
Dominic.
And if anyone has not told you today that they love you, I love you. Just for today, tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. And just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and who wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people who are not using and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear.
Just for today.
Thank you. And can we close this meeting with a moment of silence? All about the serenity prayer, please. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Just for that, works if you work.
Won't if you don't.
These lingers are hard. It's me running around here. In fact, I think I grew reefer.
What is it?
Yeah. I used to go over.